Call to order. Today's Friday, January 27, 2012. Time is 8 o'clock. Excuse me, 8:11. Representative President R, Representative Feige, Representative Seaton, Representative Peggy Wilson, Representative Cisna, absent is Representative Kawasaki, President Vice Chairman Representative Pruitt, and myself, Representative Alan Dick. We do have a quorum. Representative Kawasaki will join us shortly. Okay, our first order of the business today is HB 145. We've heard this bill Wednesday, during 8:25, and last year we heard it five times. It just seems like well-needed bread dough. We've certainly worked this one over. Sponsor has incorporated most of the suggestions from last Wednesday's meeting into a CS, which we will present shortly. At this time, I am closing public comment on HB 145, as nobody has signed up for that. So public comment is closed. We will consider an amendment by Representative Feige, and then we'll move the bill on its way. After HB 145, we will take up HB 282, Military Training Credit / Temporary License, by Representative Bill Thomas. And following HB 282, we will take testimony on SB 8, Student Questionnaires and Surveys, which we do not intend to move out of committee yet today. So first up is HB 145, Representative Pruitt. Will you move the CS, please?
Mr. Chairman, I move CS HB 145 version G, dated January 24th, 2012.
I'll for discussion.
And we have the CS before us. Representative Keller, would you come before us and summarize the changes for us? Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Representative Dick and committee, thank you. I'm Representative Wes Keller, District 14. At this point, it's traditional to say thank you. What I'd like to do is read you just a quote, just a couple sentences here. This is a quote. I think, this is in form of a thank you to you. I think with you that nothing is of more importance for the public weal than to form and train up youth in wisdom and virtue. Wise and good persons are, in my opinion, the strength of a state, much more than riches or arms. As I look at this committee, I know that's why you're here, and so my thank you is sincere. And that was Ben Franklin, by the way, 1750, so this came from a while back. I know you're in a hurry, but I found that in a book out of Friends of the Library, just a little commercial. That's a fun story. And they've got a book of all the old letters of one of our founding fathers. It's very good. What I'd like to do with the CS, with your permission, the committee's permission, is ask Ernest Prox, my staff, to come up and go over the list that reflect the changes that resulted from the discussion we've had in the past.
Ernest, just identify yourself for the record, sir.
All right, Mr. Chairman, Ernest Prox, staff to Representative Keller. There are three primary changes between the previous version Y and the current version G. The first one you can find on page 1, line 14, and it's the last sentence states, payments made under the program are subject to appropriation. The primary purpose of adding that sentence in there was that there was some confusion that was expressed by some members of the fellow staff members as to whether this program was subject to part of existing education funding or whether it was subject to a separate appropriation by the legislature. And we put this sentence in there just to clarify to both members of the legislature and also to the general public who probably isn't watching this morning, that this scholarship program is dependent on the legislature appropriating money to it so that it will function. Second change is line 2, page 5, and regardless of the attendance area or the school district in which the student resides. The original language had between the words is between attendance area or the school district. It was originally in the school district, and so we just changed it to or to clarify the statement.
Line 5,
page 2. Is it line 5, page 2, sorry.
Thank you. Okay.
And then the...
Excuse me, could you repeat that again? Because I was looking for line 2 on page 5.
Okay, yeah. Line 2, page 5, it's the original end of the sentence stated, regardless of the attendance area in the school district in which the school student resides, it is now changed to regardless of the attendance area or the school district in which the student resides. So it's changed into or. And the third and final change is page 4, lines 21 through 25, and that is the applicability of the scholarship program. This was inserted at the request of the committee chair, and I believe the language states that the scholarship program, if it is established, it doesn't apply or affect a public school that has a average daily membership of less than 50 students per year. And as far as intent goes, if you want to explain that, I will leave it up to you.
Thank you. My intention here is that I'm very concerned about small schools and the impact of this this bill on small schools. And the idea was that any school would be threatened, the existence of any school that would be threatened by this bill, this would remove that threat. And the reason I suggested 3 years on this is that a future legislature could step in and speak to that. If this bill were passed, it would be 3 years to work out the bugs, see what's happening, see what dynamics going on, and see to what degree this bill would be a threat to smaller schools. So basically, what I was suggesting is just postpone that issue within this bill for 3 years, so that a future legislature could speak to it. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just to get it kind of in my head what you're talking about, somewhere else in the bill it says that there would be, they would have 2 years for some, there's a period of 2 years somewhere in the bill about, has that been removed or... If I remember right, isn't there something about 2 years in the bill?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Wilson. It is on page 3, lines 6 through 11, so the effect on districts. And is I'm assuming that our legislative attorney, Jean Michelle, is on the line, but I'll take a stab at it. And if she wants to clarify, she can. I think the portion that was put in by the chair, at the request of the chair, that exempts that sort of pre-scholarship, that it exempts, if you're below a certain threshold, you don't have to participate in the program, or you don't participate in the program. The section on page 3, the less than 10 students, that is for those schools that that section refers to those schools that are actually participating in the program. And so, if you are participating in the program and you hit that lower than 10 student threshold, then there is a 2 year period where you're technically counting as having 10 students or more. So it's sort of the section found on, I think, page 4 is sort of pre-participation, and then the one on page 3 is actual participation.
Representative Wilson.
Just follow up on that then. It says that if there was 10 kids in the school and one went out, the funding wouldn't change for that school? It would still get the funding for 10 kids, or they would just still just get to stay open?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, my understanding is that they will still be still be treated for a period of 2 years as having a 10 student count.
a follow-up with
follow
that.
Up.
So then what we're saying is that what you're putting that in is saying that those schools that have maybe 9 kids now are going to get to stay in for 2 years, and we will fund them. But the third year, we will not fund them, and then that's the year we'll find out how many kids, how many schools are have disappeared, and then that we're going to deal with this. Is that what you're saying?
My the intent of my the portion I inserted was just to give it. It'll sunset in 3 years. Is to if this bill ever were to to mature and reach reality, that there would be a 3-year window where the bugs get worked out of what's going on. I think there's a lot of dynamics that we don't even know how it would unfold, and that we give a 3-year window for people to see how that works, and then the remainder of this would come. The remainder of this would this wouldn't sunset. This portion wouldn't sunset.
Okay, so we're in your mind, that part wouldn't sunset, but in reality, it would. The part where the two where it says, because we're putting into law that we're going to say they don't get to count, they can still have their school for 2 years no matter what, and even if they went down to 2 kids, they would still get to have their school. But by that third year, they wouldn't. But you're saying the third year we're going to go back and look at it and. Or what does yours say? I'm trying to find out what in reality will happen, because you know, it's always nice to say, well, that gives them time to figure it out. But half the time, if we don't say they have to figure it out, it doesn't get figured out.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think on the applicability portion that was inserted in on page 4, that. As it states, in the 3 years following the effective date of this act, the parental choice scholarship does not apply to. That my reading of that is correct. It's there's 3 years that this program, this scholarship is established. Schools that meet this below 50 student threshold. They're not even included in this at all, and then so after 3 years that gives them I'm assuming to the chair's intention that gives the legislature time to decide how this program is working and if it's something that we want to continue after that third year then these schools with 50 students or less they can participate. They can participate in the program. So that's, I believe that for that newly added language, I think that is how it works. Mm-hmm. If that clarifies that particular portion.
If I could comment, I think everybody, a lot of people picture, oh gee, this bill is going to pass, and there's going to be a mass exodus. As this bill is passed in other states, what we found is there are actually a very small number of students that have left the school. So again, the intent of what I inserted here was to defend the small schools so that there's the 3-year window to find out what that dynamic is. I think we'll have a lot better grasp of reality at that time. And then the remainder of this would speak to what would happen to a smaller school.
Is it
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there anybody from bill drafting that can tell us, because I don't think we know for sure, or at least I'm not, for sure, that in the 3 years following the effective date, so that means 3 years after this program starts, that means 3 years after it starts, it does not apply to, it may not affect a public school that has an average daily membership of less than 50. So that what that means to me is that the third year
that sunsets, and then this speaks to the situation.
After the third year, but after the second year, we're going to lose some of those little schools, is what I'm telling you. That's what I understand.
No, as I say, those little schools won't even be, they won't even be eligible for the scholarship program.
But you said after the third year.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, Representative Feige.
Correct me, and just a way to explain it. So in year one, two, and three, the bill will not apply to small schools.
Mm-hmm. No, that's not what it says.
In year four, it will apply to the small schools.
In the 3 years.
And if the
okay,
the population of that school drops below 10, where the school would normally be closed because it dropped below 10, we're giving them essentially a waiver to keep the school open
in the 3 years following.
For basically years four and years five.
Did you follow that?
And any subsequent years, actually.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I read this, it's not really going to apply to the school. It means that if you're a parent in a community that has a school that's under 50, you may not get a scholarship for your student to go to a private school, where if you're in a big school district, then there can be a scholarship. But if you're in a community that has a school that's less than 50, this whole program does not apply to any parent to receive a scholarship for their child to go to a private school. That's what I read this saying, because it says the program does not apply if the school size is less than that. And I think discriminating between parents on the basis of the school size is as to whether they can get a scholarship to send their child to public school is going to be problematic. And I'm glad Jean Michelle's going to be on the line, or she's not. So anyway, I think that we have a problem, Mr. Chairman, in the way that this is written, because the program isn't going to apply, but, you know, parents are the ones that are qualifying for the scholarship by having their students in a private school. So I think we need clarification, Mr. Chairman.
We did have this discussion with Ledge Legal, and Ledge Legal at the time did not see any problem with this. coming from reality, I can tell you, there's a small village where there was one individual that was vindictive, and that individual every year would pull his children out of the school in an attempt to close the school down, and he'd move them over to Palmer, and as soon as he failed, he'd move his kids back. That is to say that the small schools are they're on the cusp. The problem I see, and I understand Representative Seaton's concern, is that not every parent would have the choice of actually participating in this program. But the concern is, in a community with a small school, if a certain group of parents chose to have the school choice, they would actually be able to enforce that choice on the rest of the community by shutting down the small school. There wouldn't be enough students in the public school, you know, to keep that school open. And so that was the dilemma, is that I understand Representative Seaton's concern about, at least for 3 years, is discriminating against parents in small schools. But the consequence of not doing that is that some parents who do want their kids in a public school, that choice of having a public school would be taken away from them.
Mr. Chair,
you have a thought?
Mr. Chair, please. I had
Representative
been in the queue, I believe. I have a serious problem with kind of the structure of this, in that this has just been given to me, the new version has just been given to me. I walked into the committee a couple days ago, and a new version had been given to me. And I actually have been in the mix here of staff and then now a legislator, and watching the work on the school systems. And we keep coming up with schools that are just simply not making it compared to other states. And, of course, we have conditions in this state that are very, very different than other states. But what I'm really troubled by is that we're talking about passing this bill. So we have a very short period of time Now, to comprehend something that we need professionals here, they're going to answer how this is going to fit into a system that, as we found out in court yesterday, all of a sudden is being changed and there's new elements in it. There have been new elements in this sort of nonstop, and we're moving way fast without the time for any of us to do the kind of study we need to do to understand this. So I'm putting in my objection and hoping that somehow we figure out how to do this thing correctly, spend the time we need to do to understand a very complex amendment right here. And I do want to understand it, but I want to know what the details are, as the department is going to work with it, as teachers are going to work with it, as all of the parts.
Thank you, Representative Sisson. You know, I understand, and we understand through NCLB, that one size doesn't fit all. I don't think there's any statement you can make about a school in Alaska that isn't both true and false in Alaska. And so if we're going to find something that fits everybody perfectly, we're not going to find a fit for anything. There's no statement that we can make at all.
It's not.
If
Mr. Chair, can I just clarify, Representative Sisson, are you referring to the amendment or to the current CS? Because we haven't started discussing the amendment yet.
I'm talking about the fact that we needed, I believe, a special subcommittee that actually went through this and got all the details together. But we're right now having one thing right after the other, change, and then with a change to a change. And I'm not objecting to any one part of this, or to the sponsor, or to anything. It's the process that I'm really concerned about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure we weren't confused, that we weren't talking about the amendment yet. Okay, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Jim Michelle, I understand you're online. Would you have you heard this conversation? Jim Michelle, are you there?
Mr. Chairman, this is Jean Michelle with Legal Services. I'm sorry, I was not tuned into the meeting earlier, so I don't know what the questions are.
If you would, Annette, if you would paraphrase for Jean Michelle.
Jean, this is Annette Chrysler, staff to Representative Dick, and the questions have to do with the how the sections of the bill, Section 2, with the limitation of membership of 50 students for three school years, and Section 1431.030, the lower limit of a student count of 10, how those two sections work together in practicality.
Okay. Again, this is Jean Michelle. I'm sorry, I was muted. I was muted by accident by the LIO. This is Jean Michelle again with Legal Services. The 1431.030 provides an exclusion for schools that are less than 10 if the ADM is less than 10 because a student chooses to transfer out of the school, so that student would not be able to participate in the choice scholarship until 2 years following an increase in the ADM. The second provision provides a Section 2, page 4, provides an applicability provision, a temporary applicability provision for a 3-year period for schools that have an average daily membership of 50. So the let me go back. The applicability provision excludes those schools for a 3-year period after the effective date of the act, the schools that are less than 50. 1431030 does not exclude those students. I'm correcting myself now. That what that would require is the school size for purposes of the state aid calculation would not change if the ADM falls below 10 for that school, so that they don't lose the benefit of the school size factor for a two-year period.
So Jim, Michelle, this Representative Dick, if you would clarify, in my mind, it seems that the three-year exemption for schools under 50 would apply for the first 3 years, and page 3, lines 8 through 11, speaks to after that, if the scholarship program would apply to that community, that's when that one would kick in. Is that correct?
Yes, that's a permanent provision, 1431030.
Okay, and Representative Sisna, I've wrestled with a lot of these issues too, but my thought is we heard this how many times last year, and to be honest, as a chairman, I'm rather embarrassed that we're continuing. We had lots of time to discuss all of this, you know, along the way. So as a chairman, I'm a little embarrassed that we haven't come to a conclusion and a focus before this. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gene, I guess my question is on page 4, starting in line 22 and leaving out some of the superfluous language. It says the parental choice scholarship program established under this bill does not apply, and a scholarship may not affect a school that has an average daily attendance under 50. As I read that, it means that if you are in a community that has a school under 50, the parents do not qualify for the parental scholarship program for the 3 years, you know, the 3 years lag time. This isn't, you know, part of it also goes to school attendance membership or school size, but it also says that it can't affect them, and I'm not sure. I mean, the only way it cannot affect them is no student can get a scholarship to go to a private or religious school and remove them from the average daily attendance, regardless of the school size calculation. They would lose average daily attendance if a student isn't there. So am I correct in saying that this amendment as written means that parents in communities that have a school under 50 do not qualify for the program that's being established here for the initial 3 years?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that is correct. The provision proposed AS 1431030 is not an exclusion, but it just holds the school harmless. But the applicability provision is an exclusion. Those families would not be eligible under the program for the first 3 years.
Thank you. And follow up.
Thank
you. And do we have either constitutional due process treating people the same across the states? Are there problems of saying that if you happen to be a resident in an area that has a school under 50, you're excluded from this program, but if you're in a larger community, then you can have this state benefit?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that presents a valid question of an equal protection problem, but that doesn't mean that a court would invalidate that provision. The committee and the legislature would need to articulate these are financial questions, so they're not fundamental constitutional interests at stake here, but the the legislature would need to articulate legitimate rationale that's related to this provision, and obviously one of those policy rationales would be the potential failure of a public school in a community, particularly if it's the only school available, public school, and the effect on the remaining students. And there are some other questions, but if the legislature has a legitimate purpose and this provision is tailored to that purpose, a court would uphold it.
Yeah, thank you, Jane. In my mind, we already have that. We're already saying that if you live in a community that has less than 10 kids, you can't have a public school. So we've already drawn a line there and saying if you live in, if there's 9 kids in your village, you can't have a school. So we could turn around and say that's discriminating against people that live in a village with fewer students. Representative Pruitt.
The only thing that I was going to add, thank you, Mr. Chair, was, and I don't know if there's anyone from the department who can answer this, are there any schools out there with 50 students with private schools within the vicinity that there would be a reason of concern that they might be, the parents might not be able to send their child there? And then the second question is, because this is a 3-year provision, I guess I don't know, what does it take to set up a private school? I'm sure it's probably, you can't just jump in and you'd be able to set it up in a month and be ready for the first year. It might take some time, so that might make this 3-year provision kind of not really, I don't want to say not matter, but not be as big of a concern if you can't just run in and start a school where there isn't one already. So I don't know if there's anyone that can answer that. But
Mr. Chairman, perhaps the question we're trying to frame in terms of in regards to this particular section, in terms of who it applies to, and if I can request Jean Michelle to comment on the following question. Can the parents still, under page 4, the applicability portion, lines 21 through 25, can the parents still apply for the scholarship and the public school's funding remains affected? Or can those affected parents in that particular public school not participate in the scholarship program at all?
Through the chair, this is Jean Michelle again. That an applicability provision takes those families out of the program for that 3-year period. So the latter statement is correct.
Excuse me. Chuck Cobb, I bet you could comment and help us out here.
I could, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Chuck Cobb, for the record, staff to Senator Dyson on the Senate side, companion bill carrying. Question for Jean Michelle. Jean, the way I read this, it says that the program may not affect the funding for the public school, not that parents don't have choice to send their child out to a school of choice, only that the specific language under applicability seems to clearly indicate that the program does not apply to an apprentice choice scholarship may not affect a public school. That would indicate that a funding that is reduced because a child's parents have chosen another school, that funding may not impact that school's funding for a period of 3 years. That school that has less than 50 already, so let's say they go from 49 to 47 students, they lose 2 kids. The way this is written, it clearly states that the program, meaning the scholarship program, may not affect the funding of that school for 3 years. Not that a parent doesn't have choice, only that school's funding is protected. And then going back to the previous one under the ADM of 2, that protects schools currently that would be immediately impacted and lose their viability as a school if they drop below 10. That just says in those cases where they immediately become 9 or less that they are protected for a 2-year period. So to me, they're 2 very different things, but in neither case does it take away the choice of the parent to choose a education for their child.
Mr. Chairman, should I respond to Mr. Cobb's question?
Please do.
OK. Okay, this is Jean Michelle again. An applicability provision is not, it's not limited to a particular aspect of the program. So while it's true that the parents in the, who have students in a public school of an ADM of 50 or less may choose to send their children to a private school, there is no scholarship funding available for a three-year period for that choice under the way Section 2 is worded. If you would like to hold those schools harmless, then we would rewrite that section so that it's not an applicability section but a temporary protection, much like the proposed AS 1431030.
Well, I believe it's the intent of the sponsor to just promote parental choice, and the way it appears that you are saying it's worded is that that choice to choose an option would be limited for a three-year period now under the applicability section. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
But I have no information, I think, in response to Representative Pruitt's question, and I think the department would have to speak to the question of whether there are schools that would, or families that would actually be affected as a matter of fact. And, I don't know whether there are schools with an ADM of 50 or less that have a private school available to those families in the state.
Yeah, I understand the genuine concerns, you know, as we look at the details here. But stepping back, as I've done my homework on this, in other states and other communities where this school choice has been provided, there's actually been a very large overall benefit to everybody. The public school funding wasn't drastically reduced. There wasn't a mass exodus, but the final product is what we all want, is that is by the school choice providing choice, there was I don't want to use the word competition. There was alternatives presented to parents and to teachers and to schools that actually ended up with a better final product in terms of the public schools. Everybody benefited in places where this has been implemented. Representative Sisno.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, in your...
Go ahead.
Thank you. In your studies, did these other states that have done that, have they... Is the bill been the same as this one, with the conditions that are the same as this one, and have they had conditions in their states across vast areas that are very, very different with very small schools that are eroding? Was it similar conditions for those? Because that's what I'm really concerned
about. I understand your question. No,
no,
there's no state like Alaska. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the discussion, it's been made clear to me that I was thinking wrong. And I do understand now that the 3 years are the first 3 years, and I was thinking it was something different. Anyway, so having understood that better, I do want to make the comment. I have in my three-ring binder version G, just getting back to another question that was brought up, that I had it last night and have had time to look at it. However, it does make more sense to me now, and I do understand that, and I'm just wondering if it would be good to make sure that the 2 years and the 3 years kind of match, so that we would have 3 years that they would be held harmless, mm-hmm. and the schools that go under 10, so that it would match up with the 3 years in the other one. Although if they don't qualify, that won't make a difference, will it?
We're really talking, excuse me, yeah. Representative Wilson, we're talking about a five-year period. 3 years where it's just hold harmless, let's figure out how this thing works, and after that, after that, there would be a two-year grace period for communities to adjust.
Okay.
That's my understanding. Representative Seaton?
Mr. Chairman?
Jean Michelle, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to correct that understanding in that this two-year period is a permanent provision, mm-hmm. so that any time after that first three-year exclusion, if a school with an ADM of less than 10 is affected by a transfer to a private school, they will, that school will be held harmless for the two-year period from that point in which the mm-hmm. number drops below 10 until the number is reported to be higher than 10. So, I mean, the enrollment increases. So it's not, technically speaking, a five-year period, but a floating two-year period after the first three-year exclusion.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Gene, I'm trying to frame a question here that, because I think there is sometimes a misinterpretation that a private school would have to form in the same community and take it below 10 by kids going there, because as I think that we talked about this before, it was the school gets the funding from where the child's residence is, and that's their home residence, not, so if it's a boarding school, the private school is going to get the full funding, including a local match share from whatever funding source that is, including the geographic cost differential, whatever the resident district is getting. Let's say it's somebody from Tyonic or from anywhere else that has a higher cost differential, or let's say it's Bethel or one of the smaller communities. So when we were talking about the funding that was going to go based on residency of the person, not the residency of the school, that meant that boarding schools would get that, correspondence schools would get that amount, whatever the private school is, I mean, it can't exceed their, what they have as their costs of education, but so is it correct that a school doesn't have to form in that community and there doesn't have to be delay, it just has to mean that a student is taking a scholarship someplace from a private school within the state?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that is correct as long as the student maintains its his or her residency in the home district, the public district. The private school could be located anywhere in the state. However, the transportation costs might be discouraging to a family to do that as a practical matter.
Yeah, Representative Seaton?
Just following up, though. On the funding issue, let's say it's someone from a village, Hooper Bay, someplace else that has a you know, a very large cost differential, and this is a boarding school. As long as the student goes back and maintains their residency in a small community, the private school is going to get the full funding of where it would be in the residential community. Where that student maintains their full residence, their permanent residency under the bill. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gene, would you explain on page 3 the section 1431.030? Will you explain that to us?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I did a very poor job of explaining that earlier in the meeting, but I let me try it again. if a student count falls below 10 as a result of parental choice scholarship, that school is held harmless. The student may move to the private school and the scholarship is paid as long as it's been appropriated, but the school will still be treated for the purposes of the school size factor as a school of with a size of 10, since we, generally speaking, close schools when they fall below that number. And that's for a two-year period until either the enrollment increases or the school is closed.
Representative Wilson.
So we're just talking about a two-year period of time here? Because I thought you said earlier that it was a floating 2 years.
Oh, yes, through the chair, Representative Wilson. What I meant by that was it could occur at any point in time through the life of the program, the two-year for any particular school.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Jean, you're doing very well. You stepped in the middle of a pretty lively conversation, and your explanation was just fine. Representative Seaton.
Yes, on this point, Jean, the way this is written, does this mean that the school would be treated the same as 10 for the district cost factor, but they're not going to receive the ADM for the students that aren't there? So it would maintain that they could, let's say it's a rural school that has a high ADM, let's say they're with their geographic cost differential, it's $15,000. They're going to lose that for every student that leaves, but the district cost factor would still remain the same for calculation of aid. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, this provision only speaks to the school size factor, not the district cost factor, but obviously the district cost factor does apply to that school. And it uses the ADM.
Right. So I just wanted to clarify that. So if a school went down to 5, they're not going to be funded as if they had 10 students in the school. The cost factor to the district will still remain the same, but they're only going to get the ADM and the funding for 5 students, not for 10 students. Just wanted to be clear that that was the way this applies, since we're really only maintaining the district cost factor, we're not maintaining the average daily membership as if it was fully 10.
If I could comment here, I lived in a village that actually closed a school, and whatever little bad math might be going on in the act of giving a school a two-year grace period, let me tell you, it's nothing compared to the cost of shutting a school down. And, I mean, that's extensive. There's a lot of paperwork. There's transferring a title and everything else. So my understanding is that to be less than 10 in this section, the school would be funded for 10 students. Is that correct, Gene? That is not correct.
This is Jean Michelle again. Under the proposed 1431.031 only speaks to the school size factor under 1417.450, but that school size factor creates an adjusted student count. There is no multiplier for a school with a student count of 10 to 20 students. So the 1417.450 would normally require that school, if it fell below 10, that they would be included in the ADM within the same school district with the lowest ADM. It's determined by the most recent student count data. That wouldn't happen for a two-year period.
Okay, and given that everybody would have a three-year grace period to see this coming, I don't see it as a big issue. The school districts would have a chance to plan ahead in 3 years. Representative Wilson, you had a comment?
Not right now.
Okay. Okay, this has been good conversation. Is there any amendment that would come out of this conversation?
Mr. Chairman,
please.
Our intent with this section is that the school be funded as if it had an ADM account of 10, if I'm correct, if I understand it correctly. If that's not what it does, we can, Mr. Leonard, we can consider changing it to reflect that intent if that's not what it does right now.
At ease? Want to amend that? In the meantime, are there any other amendments to, from committee members?
Amendments or questions on the CS?
Any other question on the CS?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
I at our last meeting, I laid out several issues at the last to. Address, and one was on page, that was two of the Y version, and that was where it's on line 30, that a private correspondence study program located or operated entirely in the state.
What page, ma'am?
Page two.
Page two.
Yeah.
Of Y.
And we could go, yeah, I've got Y version. I could do it in G, just a minute.
If you would.
That would be on G version, that would be page 2, line 31.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at that, and page 2, line... line 9, that they would, the school would receive the same amount of as a participating school. So does this mean that if it's a private correspondence study school and under the scholarship program they're going to receive the same basic aid and local contribution that would be applicable to a student in their where the student resides? In other words, do we have a case, the way the bill is written, in which correspondence students in a private or a religious school are going to receive the full amount of aid, and not only state aid, but state aid plus the amount of the local aid, whereas if it's a public correspondence school, it does not receive, it receives 80% of the funding formula. Because I think that that's the way it's written, is that if you're in the private correspondence school, you're going to receive more money, or the state's going to be paying more in the scholarship money through this program than they do through the public correspondence school. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, I'm going to let Chuck handle that one.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Seaton. Through the chair, this is Chuck Kopp for the record. Representative Seaton, this, again, the funding mechanism is in subparagraph B on page 2, lines 5 through 9. What that says is that the program is funded at the lesser of the cost of tuition at the participating school. So if that statewide private correspondence school is located entirely in the state, whatever their published tuition rate, in practicality speaking, that would be the cost that would be funded under this program, unless that cost exceeded that a child would receive in the district where they reside. In that case, and assuming a fully funding scenario, the program was fully funded, then yes, you're right, that child would receive the equivalent of the geographic location, the local aid in the district where they live.
Okay, so following up, Mr. Chairman, I just, you know, since I made the comment and requested that to be addressed, and it's still the same in this bill, we have a situation in which we're saying if it's funded by the legislature and we have not put any percentages of underfunding in this bill, this bill says that it can be fully funded, then we have a situation in which we're saying if a private correspondence school has a high tuition rate, they will receive more money for correspondence school than any public correspondence schools allowed, because public correspondence schools are only allowed 80% of the ADM. And I just want to make sure that we realize that we are setting up this as a greater funding for private schools than they are for public schools.
Would the sponsor like to comment?
Well, it, Representative Seaton, that question does assume that the private school correspondents would approach the level of 80% of the funding for a similarly situated student. I mean, we're we can guess that that tuition may be that high. In practical experience, it's largely much more competitive than that. But you're right, unless we assign a specific percentage that they are allotted, the scenario that you put forward, it's possible for that to happen.
Right. Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Feige mentioned it the other day that, you know, what normally happens is the state is funding something and they'll fund it at a high level, the tuitions will generally work to that high level. And so I'm concerned that, you know, you can have a tuition that's high and then you can give waivers for certain things, and we haven't figured out whether, you know, so that you, if you don't get full funding because you're not from a rural area or something that has a high geographic cost differential, then there could be, you know, there's all kinds of ways it can be done, but the structure of the bill allows for greater funding for private schools than it does for the public school, and that's the point. Thanks.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and you know, Representative Seaton's actually, you know, correct. And I believe that the price of those private schools, the tuition for those private correspondence schools will rise to charge the amount available. And that result is, you know, would students go from the public correspondence schools to the private correspondence schools? I don't know. It's largely immaterial to the actual student and parents that are making that decision. So you're still going to have the competition in quality of program, not so much competition on price, but in all fairness to the state, you may end up, you know, are you going to end up with people, are you going to end up killing the public correspondence programs, which serve a useful purpose as well? In all fairness, perhaps it's wise to make the level of funding for correspondence programs equal.
Would you like to offer an amendment?
Representative Seaton would like to offer an amendment. It's his idea.
Mr. Chairman, I put this to the sponsors because I see it as a real problem in the bill. You know, I think it needs to be addressed somehow, but I didn't craft an amendment to this bill. I related to, you know, in the committee that this was a problem and that we should address it. And it hasn't been addressed in the current CS, but on the fly here, I'm not prepared to offer the amendment to fix that.
If I could,
Representative Keller.
If I could, to the committee, this is Representative Keller, just for a quick comment. I just would commit to the committee that we will deal with this in the education committee on the, you know, as far as the formula and how it works, so that there's no.
Excuse me, Representative Kelly. You'll deal with it in which committee?
I'm sorry, that's the education. I meant finance committee, where it's going next. So thank you.
Okay. Representative Seaton, thank you for helping us become aware of this. You drilled down far deeper than I had, so I appreciate the comment.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to say I do appreciate the sponsors saying that this education issue shouldn't be dealt with in education, that they'll deal with it someplace else. But, you know, this is the Committee of Jurisdiction on Education, education funding, and those, and the design. And I would just like to say that I believe that, you know, the bill should be fixed in education, not in finance. Finance has a million things to do, and they're not delving into these educational issues as the Committee of Jurisdiction does. So I would just...
Representative Wilson.
And I would like to make a comment about the policy call that we will be making when we allow the schools that will be taking children to say, no, we aren't going to take you. In other words, right now the policy of our public school is you take everyone. And the very fact that a school can say, oh, sorry, we don't have a special education person here. Well, many of the little schools never did either, but they had to take them no matter what. And that's a public policy call that we're making as a state when we are saying if there's public money going to it, then it should be open enrollment. And I think that's a public policy call that we need to decide on. And that hasn't happened. But I think it's something critical that we need to think about. Because if we pass this, we are saying that state money can be used, but they can say who they're taking and who they're not.
Representative Pruitt?
I would caution, I think charter schools are not open enrollment, and public funding does go to those. So it's on a different scale, but I do believe it does apply, that there is limitations. Okay.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we've dealt with that.
You had another issue.
Yes, I had another issue, and that was what I brought up at the last one, which is on G version is on page 3, line 29. We're saying that the department shall adopt regulations to carry out the program in a manner that ensures the highest number of student and school participation. And Mr. Chairman, I see this as very problematic because we are to ensure the highest participation means that the regulations are going to have to be written to be as detrimental as possible to the public schools, because we are saying that we're going to ensure the highest number of participants, so therefore the greatest benefits have to be given and the greatest of everything has to be done there to ensure it. So this is a shall and ensure, and I believe that that is not an appropriate designation in a statute for a program that is starting out and has in fact, it violates the Constitution currently. If a constitutional amendment passes, then it wouldn't violate it, but it's a current violation of the Constitution. And to say that we're going to pass something out that we're going to ensure that the maximum number of students and schools participate is not, I don't think, appropriate.
Comments and sponsor.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Seaton. This is under the regulation 1431040 proposed, and it refers to administrative process that, frankly, our charter schools, other alternative schools of choice, are always crying out for more efficiencies in process and how they can set up their schools of choice and basically working within the system. It's a statement, I think, a very good statement of legislative intent, that just as we want our charter schools to have freedom in how they form and set up and be approved, that the bureaucratic processes in place would facilitate schools entering the program. And that has everything to do with the application form that they must submit to the certification of their operating costs, to the reporting requirements. So everything from setting it up to administrating it to their enrollment periods and timelines, certainly there's going to be a operational guidance that they have to supply. And this is merely a statement that look for ways to make it user-friendly and don't want to read it more into it than that.
Mr. Chairman.
Jimmy, Representative Seaton.
I could understand that if it was in an intent section. This is not in an intent section. This is in the bill that says that the department shall and ensure. So this, I don't think anyone should take this as this is merely an intent. Otherwise, it would be in an intent section. Maybe that's what the sponsor intends to do, and it should be changed to an intent section. But that's not the structure of the bill that we have before us. This bill is mandatory on the department to do that and to ensure that. And so if there's anything that is even slightly not even reporting requirements, if you're going to make sure that every private school doesn't have to report because reporting or something else isn't going to be ensuring the highest participation, then we put the department in a mandatory situation where they shall do regulations that ensure something. So, Mr. Chairman, I just, whether it's in the wrong section, there is no intent section that I see. So, but it's a problem for me.
Representative Feige.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Say on line 29, I understand what Representative Seaton is implying here. Would it be a solution to change the wording on line 29 to say in a matter that ensures a high number of students instead of the highest? Is that reasonable?
I'm pondering.
And would that be acceptable to the sponsor?
Or could we, excuse me, could we maybe say in a manner that facilitates, would that create the intent?
Mr. Chairman, that would be up to Representative Keller, not myself, to make that call.
Representative Keller.
For the record, this is Representative Keller. I think the word facilitates would clarify the confusion and is a very good suggestion.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you're going to offer an amendment to somewhat of that effect, I would suggest that we take out the highest number of students, or highest number out, so it would be facilitates participation of students in schools or something, instead of trying to get a designation of the highest number in some ways is going to be very problematic because it puts
a burden on them.
A burden, yes.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, would it be acceptable to say to carry out the program in a manner that facilitates participation of students in schools? That facilitates student and school participation.
That was my suggestion to the chairman, but
Thank you. Representative Feige, you had a amendment that would just take out in a matter from the word in to the word participation and just delete that. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. We don't necessarily need to specify exactly what our intent here. We just want to give the department the authority to adopt the regulations. Just give them that authority and let them drive on.
Excuse me?
Representative
Sisson. Just a question. Doesn't this piece of legislation do that?
In this paragraph?
Well, no, but doesn't this legislation give the department that, does it need to be in the bill when you, in fact, are laying out the bill to do this? And maybe I just don't understand.
Then you're agreeing with the amendment.
I'm wondering why have this section in here, because I think it already does that. The bill does that, doesn't it? I need somebody to explain that to me.
Representative Seaton?
Mr. Chairman, I think this is a bill that is a separate scholarship program that is not at all connected to the regular funding that the department takes care of. And so I guess the question, is it going to be the, you know, Council of Churches, or is it going to be the department that proposes it, puts in regulations for this special scholarship? Okay. This is a special scholarship that's outside of the others. So I think that the purpose of putting this is to say that the department is the one that's going to make the regulations to govern the program.
Okay.
My
excuse me, Representative Feige, did you making an amendment?
Yes.
Do I hear a second?
Can you repeat?
Let me say what the amendment is.
Yes.
Okay. Are we up to Amendment 4?
No. We're still on the amendment.
Excuse me,
Mr. Chairman.
That is? Maybe.
That is. We will come to order. Representative Seaton questioned, are you willing to remove your objection to this? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I am willing to remove my objection to the adoption of the CS. That doesn't mean that I'm pleased with the CS entirely, and there will be amendments to the CS. Yes. I remove my objection to adoption of the CS.
Representative, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I still have a question I would like answered.
Representative Wilson, the idea, we're going to set this aside right now. And so we need to,
okay,
what I'd like to do is have Representative Feige speak to move his amendment. And at that point, we're going to set this whole thing aside,
okay,
and deal with it later. So, Representative Seaton, I understand what you said, and we'll certainly work on that. Representative Feige, do you would you like to move your amendment? With no objection, the CS is adopted. Thank you. Representative Feige, you want to move your amendment, and at that point, we will we'll set this bill aside.
Mr. Chairman, to which amendment are you referring? The one regarding regulations?
Yeah, one we were just referring to.
Okay.
Page 3, line 29 and 30.
Yes, I'm ready to move that amendment.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move that we amend page 3, line 29 by changing that paragraph to say the department shall adopt regulations necessary to carry out the program, including the one procedures for calculating. So we eliminate the text on line 29 from in a manner all the way to school participation.
Okay. Is there any objection?
I have.
Okay.
Because you said to school participation, and I think what you would like to say is that you're going to eliminate all the way from in a manner to comma including.
Yeah. Okay, so it should say carry out the program including, and then continue. Yes.
Very good. And did I hear an objection?
I'll remove my objection now because that's it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the amendment is adopted. And we will set this aside, and we will pick it up again on Wednesday at, we're going to have next Wednesday in the morning. We have a very, very intense meeting, and we will pick this up Wednesday at 3 o'clock. Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, can we have the...
Listening?
Can we have the department...
At ease.
place for those that those transportation needs, and would we be committing through the scholarship fund to fund that transportation? In other words, you know, to basically boarding schools or other participation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sisna.
Yeah, and I know over here it's kind of far away. I also would like to ask that the department speak to the issue of what I take to be actually a moral issue, and that is disadvantaged our challenged students that require special services, and how that would play out in this, because I still haven't gotten clarification on that.
Okay, we are going to set this aside, and moving on, we have...
Chairman,
go ahead, sir.
Secretary.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, we did not get Representative Seaton's question on the record.
Okay.
If you could repeat that.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. I would like to make sure that at the next meeting on this bill that we have the department to address the transportation issues and whether the participating school requirement here would apply to travel and also for boarding school travel as well. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, moving on. We have a CS for HB 282, and Ernst, thank you, sir. Military Training Credit Temporary License. Representative Pruitt, will you move the CS, and then we'll hear from the sponsor or staff to explain the minor changes.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, move CS for HB 282, version E. January 25, 2012.
And anybody want to object? Thank you, Representative Kawasaki. And we have the CS before us. Aaron, would you explain the changes and present the bill? We do have your list of witnesses.
For the record, I'm Aaron Schroeder, staff to Representative Thomas. Changes for CS for HB 282 are as follows. On page 1, line 9, we deleted the word relevant. Page 1, paragraph A, reorganize the section, adds two subsections. Section 1 added the term equivalent, and that is to allow the department or board to determine if the training is equivalent. We feel that's stronger, clearer language for the department. Section 2 is just a restatement of language from Section 1 of Version B, which deals with occupations who issue temporary licenses. Page 2, paragraph B, we added a citation 08010508-9. That is the authorization in statute that gives the department the authority to issue temporary licenses. Page 2, line 11. Add a citation for subparagraphs 2 through 5 as a language refers to licensing practices already in statute. Page 2, subparagraph capital A, adds maintain the licenses or certification in active status before at the time of application. This makes clear that the license needs to be current when they apply for a temporary license. Page 2, subparagraph B, we reworded that section to recognize military certificates of technical training as requested by the Department of Defense. Page 2, paragraph C, added for an applicant who is on active duty. This would apply for expedited licenses to individuals who already hold a license and are on active duty. Page 3, line 12, we deleted paragraph D as it was not appropriate guidance for the Post-Secondary Education Commission. Instead, we added paragraph on line page 4, added paragraph B, That language was suggested by the Post-Secondary Education Commission, and it is focused to protect the institution from jeopardizing their accreditation. Page 5, Section 5, added guidance for the DCCED and applicable boards to immediately develop necessary regulations. Acronym I use there is the refers to the Division of Corporation Businesses and Professional Licensing. Page 5, Section 6, add effective date of December 31st, 2013 for Sections 1 through 4. This was requested by the department to give them time to develop the plan and get regulations in place. Page 6, Section 7 is immediately effective for Section 5, and that concludes the changes to the CS.
Thank you. And just for those of us that aren't entirely familiar with this, would you give us just the overview of?
Sure. Yeah. The focus of House Bill 282 is to assist the transition of our military members into civilian life, whether it be they retired or separated from active duty. As we know, unemployment is a focus of concern for nationally and both in the state. For separating military members of Gulf War II, so post 9/11 vets, their unemployment rate overall is about 13% nationally. Now, Alaska's veteran unemployment rates are typically about 1 to 2% lower than the national average. However, this last year's Veterans Summit, this came up as a concern, and they brought up the idea for this bill to help them transition into the workforce. In 2010, Alaska saw about 1,200 service members separate from the military here, and are currently, they maintained a address of the state of Alaska. Of those 1,200 people, a fraction of those people will need to kind of fill the gap, so to speak, in education and in occupational areas to kind of help them transition into the workforce better. Overall intent of House Bill 282 is to ask the Division of Corporations and the Division of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licensing, the University of Alaska, and Vocational Education, with the assistance from the Alaska Workforce and Investment Board, to assess if there is a military equivalent to any of their programs that they offer. And this bill also would ask that active duty members who are currently licensed in other states would receive an expedited license if they need to relicense in the state of Alaska. Mr. Chairman, that's pretty much the overall scope of the bill and why we brought it forward today.
Thank you. Any comments from committee? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the intent of this, Mr. Chairman, I think the intent of this bill is very good. Do we have or have we received any correspondence from any of the professional licensing boards on this bill at all? I just didn't have them in my packet, I guess.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we do have some witnesses here to answer questions from that board department if you have them.
The answer is no, we didn't receive correspondence.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Sisna?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I wanted to speak to the fact that this change is a change a little bit similar to one that I knew the people who worked for getting it possible to have the state actually pay attention to volunteer work as being something that actually they paid attention to when they were hiring, and it actually increases the possibility for people to be spending maybe years in volunteer work in critical areas and then being hired with there being credit given for that. And this kind of does some of the same kind of thing. And the thing that I think is really important here is to try to bring as many people as possible. And the fact that the university is involved is really good. But when people come into Alaska serving in the military, they do slowly fall in love with the state. And it would be really, really great for us to be trying to promote this kind of thing as much as possible so that they put more energy in to their work in the military, knowing that it is something that's going to be critical for choices later. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The fact, I'm looking at the fiscal note, and the fact that it has changed, there is a change in revenues. Now, I know that that change is going to be taken care of through the boards and commissions, because those licensing fees for those various boards will go up because they have to have somebody else to start doing some of this, and the cost is usually incorporated in the license fee. So just want to make the comment that we know that that probably will happen in various areas. I think it's a wonderful thing, because I think that the quicker our military personnel can get to work when they get back, the transition is much easier. I think when they have time on their hands, you know, I think that's very difficult for them. They're used to working under so much adrenaline all the time, and then when it just goes and there's no adrenaline, that's very, very difficult emotionally. And I think this is a great bill, and good luck on it.
Thank you. If there's no other questions of the sponsor, Mark Sansouci with the Office of the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense is online to testify. Mark, are you there?
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair and Committee. Thank you for this opportunity to express Department of Defense support for the Veterans Credit House Bill 282. My name is Mark Sansouci. I'm the Department of Defense Regional Liaison for Military Families in the Northwest, sitting down here in Tacoma, Washington. Sorry I can't be there today in person. I hope to make it up there in the future for hearings. As Aaron alluded to, last year with 1 million veterans unemployed and with the post 9/11 unemployment rate for our veterans of 13.3% and an unemployment rate for 18 to 24-year-old veterans at 21.9%, the Department of Defense began supporting efforts in the states to ask states to give separating service members credit so they will not be held back from finding employment or in finishing a degree. I know time is of the essence for you, so I'm going to just cut to the quick and the main points here. Last year, four states enacted new laws to help credit our veterans grant our veterans credit towards licensing in our academics. So far in the 2012 session, and this is as of this morning, we have 27 bills in 15 more states resembling the one before you today that we are asking you to support. We want you to know that it's important that we're not asking for direct licensure if it is not equivalent. In cases where the regulatory agency or board determines partial credit, but it saves time and expense and helps a veteran get to where they're looking to go, even if not completely, that's what we seek. We are only seeking credit where credit is due. A couple of other points. You and I have already paid for this veterans training within the DOD schools and years of military experience while they served our nation by paying our federal tax dollars. Also, the more credit given to a veteran towards licensing or a degree or certification in the state, the more school slots can be made available to civilians in programs where there may be waiting lists to get on. It's important that you know, and the Department of Commerce now knows this better, that right now the Department of Defense is working feverishly with the United States Department of Labor to link service transcripts of military occupations with civilian to private sector licensing requirements. And they're asking state authorities in the pilot states of Washington, Illinois, and Maryland to review select military occupations to determine whether training and experience is sufficient to be rendered useful in licensing, giving licensing credit. Right now, the Department of Defense is working with the military services to simplify the process of programs of instruction to help with the evaluation of academic transcripts. And Aaron alluded to the fact that Alaska has thousands of veterans. As a matter of fact, in 2010, it was 1,286 who separated and retired back to Alaska, and I'm waiting on 2011 data as we speak. But at 1,286 annually, we expect, with the high quality of life, as Representative Cisna alluded to, people fall in love with Alaska, that many will continue to choose to live in Alaska when they transition into their civilian careers. And finally, I'm asked a lot about what other states are doing in this area. In May 2011, Washington State passed two bills, one for medical occupations and one for non-medical occupations, and it went into law on July 22nd of last year, modifying some 35 occupations. It's considered a best practice legislation, and your bill is modeled after the Washington State one and would also be considered a best practice. Washington State, incidentally, has 6,000 veterans annually who choose to separate or retire from the military and live there, and the Departments of Health and Licensing came in with zero fiscal notes last year when this bill was being legislated. So, and finally, we're asking for your help and asking for your support on this effort, and I stand by to answer any questions you may have. Thank you very much.
Mark, thank you for your testimony. That convinced me. Any other questions of Mark? Thank you, Mark. Also in the room, we have Chris Christensen, legislative liaison for the University of Alaska Fairbanks, here in person. Chris, if you come forward and just identify yourself for the record, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen, Associate Vice President for the University of Alaska. It feels very strange to identify myself that way after 21 years representing the judiciary in this building. As you know, Wendy Redmond retired several months ago after years of threatening to do so. It's going to be impossible to replace her the 40 years of institutional memory and the tremendous knowledge of higher education that she made available to you. I have a very steep learning curve, but I'll do my best not to slow you down, and I do ask for your indulgence this year. I'm here today just to talk briefly about Section 2 of the bill, which directs the university to adopt policies and procedures to award credit for military training, education, and service. I'd like to begin by noting that the university is committed to offering a quality educational experience to our active duty military veterans and their dependents. GI Jobs, which is a magazine and web portal that is devoted to people who are transitioning from the military back to civilian life, has designated both UAA and UAF as GI Jobs military-friendly schools. Only 15% of the colleges, universities, and vocational schools in the country got this designation. I think it's a pretty sad commentary on the state of education in the lower 48 that only 15% of the colleges and schools are considered military-friendly. That's probably why the Department of Defense is pushing this legislation nationally. The web portal Guide to OnlineSchools.com, which is a comprehensive authority on distance education and online learning, just released its 2012 rankings of the most military-friendly online colleges in the country. And of the vast multitude of such colleges and universities, UA was ranked number 5. So we're very proud of that. And as the entity that provides the funding that makes that possible, I think this committee, the legislature, should be very proud of that also. Now, while trying to learn the university over the last few months, the single issue I have heard about the most is transfer of credit. Everybody's got a story. It's a subject that arouses great passion, and military transfer credit is part of that bigger issue. The Board of Regents does have a written policy that campuses must accept and transfer as much credit as is appropriate to a student's new degree. We believe that awarding appropriate credit to service persons is one of the university's core responsibilities and another way we can show our commitment to the military. There are, as I've worked this bill in the Senate companion over the last week, I've discovered there are actually a lot of misconceptions about what the university is currently doing in the area of military transfer credit. We do manage these at the campus level, although there is intentionally a great deal of uniformity through the system. All three campuses transfer credit based on recommendations made by ACE. That acronym stands for the American Council of Education. For over 65 years, since the end of World War II, ACE has been the entity that has had the written agreement with the Department of Defense to review military training and experience and equate it to civilian credit so that campuses around the country can give those service people credit for their military service and experience. Thousands of colleges and universities use the ACE recommendations, and our three campuses actually have written agreements with the Department of Defense to use those recommendations. We are also a member of the SOC Consortium. SOC stands for the Service Members Opportunity Colleges. This is a network of about 1,900 colleges and universities around the country that enroll military veterans and dependents in special degree programs. Its purpose is to let the military get degrees as opposed to simply collecting credit as they move from base to base around the country. To be part of SOC, we've had to enter into written agreements to accept credit very readily from the other member institutions and to limit the number of credits that students have to learn here to get one of our degrees. For example, in order to get an associate's degree at UAA, a military student would only need three UAA credits, three credits earned here. The rest of the credits we will accept from all the other stock institutions. We're currently accepting about 51 credits per student from those military students who attended the various regionally accredited military institutions like the Community College of the Air Force and the service academies. You can use 30 credits of typical training for the Bachelor of Emergency Management degree or 90 credits for a General Studies BA that doesn't require satisfying particular major requirements. These degrees have sort of been set up with service members in mind. We have no limitation on the number of military credits that we'll accept. We used to, but we've done away with those. UAA as recently as last year. It's part of our continual process to make the system more student-friendly, more military-friendly. Now, Mr. Chairman, I could go on and on, but the bottom line, I don't have figures for the entire institution, but just using UAA as an example, last year UAA accepted over 15,000 credits from service people, credits for their service, credits for military education, credits for military training. And in fact, in the neighborhood of 99.5% of all the credits that were submitted for military training and education were accepted. You know, Mr. Chairman, Alaska, I think, is widely known as to service people as a state that welcomes them and that appreciates them. And I think that Alaska's university, as demonstrated by our existing policies, reflects those prevailing social values. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I wish every bill that came before us was this this much of a winner. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Any other comment? Okay. Also in the room, if we do need Crystal Koneman, Legislative Liaison, Department of Commerce and Community Economic Development, is here. Diane Behrens, Executive Director, Commissioner on Post-Secondary Education. Jess Selvey, Executive Director, Alaska Workforce Investment Board, is online to answer any questions. Are there any comments or questions from the committee? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Could we have the department come forward and address the occupational licensing?
Don't have it or answer chambers.
Okay, thank you. Just please identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Don Habiger, Director of Corporations, Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, and with me today is Sarah Chambers. She is our program coordinator for all of professional licensing. That was redundant for the state.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, I think this is an excellent idea. I want to get to the mechanics. Is there anything in the construction of the bill that we have before us that is problematic for occupational licensing?
With the adoption of version E, first of all, I'd like to say the sponsors and sponsor staff were very responsive to us, and we believe version E takes care of our concerns. One of the reasons we asked for some of these dates for implementation or a longer timeline is because we felt original version was putting us under too much of a time constraint to roll this out. With these responses in the version E, we believe we can implement it with existing resources, and with that we believe we can render a different fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That answered my question.
Okay, good. Any other comments or questions from the committee? Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A very well presented bill, Aaron. And just like to say that the military folks, when they leave the service, do have a tremendous amount of skills that oftentimes in the past have not gotten fully documented. Anything we can do as a legislature to attract these people to our state. It's been my experience in the workforce that that veterans typically have a very good work ethic. They work well together as part of a team and tend to be fairly valuable members of whatever workforce they're associated with. Anything we can do as a legislature to bring these folks into our workforce and into our state is beneficial for the state, and this bill will certainly go a long way to helping make Alaska more competitive and take those veterans away from outside and bring them here.
Oh, we want them.
You betcha.
Thank you. Representative Kawasaki, are you willing to remove your objection to the adoption of the CS?
Yes.
Thank you. Any other amendments from the committee members? Any objections to adopting the CS? Seeing none, CS is adopted. Chris, you're not the only one on a learning curve here. Representative Seaton.
Do we have anybody to testify on the bill from public hearing?
No.
Good. I just wanted to...
Thank you for checking. Yeah.
And you should close that.
I'm not that person.
Public comment. Testimony is closed. Thank you, Representative Seaton. I have lots of good coaches here. Okay, Representative Pruitt, I would entertain a motion to move the bill from committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move CSHB 282 from the House Education Committee with the individual recommendations and the zero fiscal notes from the University of Alaska and the Department of Labor and Workforce Development Workforce Investment Board.
Objection for clarification.
Representative Seaton.
We have a fiscal note from DCCED, and I didn't hear that mentioned, so I want to make sure that I think they're going to revise it, is what they told us, but I don't think we want to not include their fiscal note, and then they'll revise it between here and the next committee.
So let me clarify it with accompanying fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sisno.
If I could quickly make a comment, because I have to bring the health aspect into this thing. I thought it was fascinating that there was a zero fiscal note in the Washington State legislature when they heard this. And it just reminds us that when we're having people immigrating into the state and into our workforce, you don't normally have people coming in with as good a health record as you're going to have from the military. Yeah. I mean, it's a real plus.
Thank you.
Okay, we do have a motion to move this CS to HB 282 from committee. Do we have a second for that? Any objection? No. If not, HB 282 moves in committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying zero fiscal notes. Members will sign the committee report as it comes around.
It's not zero.
Okay.
The accompanying fiscal note. Not
I can't even read the script.
Well,
accompanying zero fiscal. We'll okay. Accompanying fiscal note. Okay. We do need to take any of these while we pass it around, right?
No.
Okay. Moving on. Announcement. We will not be meeting on Monday, January 30, but we will be meeting on Wednesday, February 1, to take up HB 256, repeal of state intervention in schools. We have a full slate of interesting witnesses. I encourage everybody to be here, and we look forward to a lively discussion. And if there's no further business before us, but I do want to mention the sponsor of SB 8. I promise you we will get to you just as soon as we can, sir. And we will recess Wednesday's meeting to 3 p.m. to take up HB 145. We need to get closure on that one. All amendments should be delivered to the committee aid by Monday, January 30, by 5 p.m., if you would. Okay? See, it's been good conversation. It's been healthy. So, is there no further business before us? House Education Committee is adjourned.